reality as we are in the middle of this Israeli genocide. I mean, I'd like to hear your perspective based on international law regarding both sides of this current situation.
Under international law, an occupying force, an occupying state is permitted to maintain the de minimis or the minimum amount of security apparatus until there's a resolution as to the occupation. And that may mean small military outposts. That may mean the presence of occupying military or security forces. It does not permit the introduction of, as they have here, some 800,000 largely European colonialist Jews into the West Bank. It does not permit the theft of land and the establishment of so-called settlements. It does not permit for the building of walls. It does not permit for the establishment of infrastructure, of economy, of an infrastructure, a system that is comparable basically to a city. It doesn't permit it. And what they do, Israel, again, in going one step further, they decided because it's quote-unquote a military zone, then people that have been in the military zone for for thousands of years are not entitled to due process of the occupying state. They're not entitled to get access to Israeli courts. And as we've seen for years now, even those Israelis going through the Israeli court system are denied any real modicum of justice, due process, and equal protection with a system of government in which the Knesset can largely overrule what the court system wants to do. So what they've done is they've established this military system. It's staffed by military judges, by military security people out of uniform, are not civilians. Israeli police out of uniform are not civilians. Settlers that are carrying weapons are not civilians. Settler outposts that have heavy-duty weapons is not a civilian outpost. So there's that whole definition. But clearly, children, the elderly, the infirm are civilian under international law and should not be removed. But the problem that we have is not knowing who did what, when, where, why, or how, with just competing narratives. But when we talk about competing narratives, there's no debate over what's going on in Gaza. There's no debate what's been going on in Palestine for 75, 80, 85 years, even before the United Nations crafted Israel. Response to that is, Israel proved your case. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction not just over Palestine because it's a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Well, I can't believe we're still watching this murder take place on a daily basis. What can be done to stop this genocide immediately, in your perspective?
The ICC has enough probable cause and has enough evidence to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and a dozen of his top advisors. That immediately limits their ability to travel. That immediately sends a message to people that want to come there to meet with them, conspire with them. That raises the accountability and the concern, because that really sends the message, okay, you are a suspected criminal. There is an arrest warrant for you. We're going to file it with Interpol. There is some standing for the notion that assets can be frozen, which Iran is well versed in, although it's been used not legally against Iran over the years, but as a political weapon. Assets can be frozen. Organizations, private entities that are now providing money, that are now providing weapons, that are now providing technical support to the Israeli government are on notice that you are, if you continue, you may yourselves be involved in criminal wrongdoing. The General Assembly can ask the ICJ for an immediate recommendation. There is universal jurisdiction in many countries in this world. Claims can be brought. They've been started already in South Africa, which is similar to the ICC to the extent that they have the power to issue arrest warrants based upon probable cause. Red notices are set with Interpol. In states themselves, for example, in the United States, there can be an effort, there should be, lobbying and political effort to impose the Arms Export Control Act, which will freeze funding and weapons for Israel. There are domestic jurisdiction issues where if I'm a Palestinian and I have Palestinian-American or Palestinian who happens to be in the United States right now, who has family, businesses, homes, et cetera, that have been destroyed, who have been executed, that have been victimized by war crimes, they can attempt to bring domestic actions in domestic courts under U.S. law, There's an issue of what's called extraterritoriality, which has to do with the ability of U.S. courts to reach out for activity and conduct overseas directed at U.S. But keep in mind, the U.S. has had more than a few examples over the years of Palestinian American citizens, including famed journalists, that have been executed by Israel. And the Department of Justice has done nothing in the United States. So again, there's that double standard. So there is an ability to move the ICC, to bring an advisory opinion action in the International Court of Jurisdiction of Justice, for universal jurisdictions to file arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other leaders of the military, to begin to identify businesses. And we know there have been lawsuits in the United States that have gone after tax-exempt organizations that provide money illegally that are tax-exempt to so-called settlements in the occupied West Bank and the Palestinian territories. So there is a combination of actions which can be brought domestically and internationally, which can be saying to Israel enough. But at this point, there have been 20,000 Palestinians who have lost their lives, almost all of them civilians, 60% of them children. 75% of Gaza is in ruins. 1.5 million people have been displaced. No food, no water, no electricity, no medical attention. Who knows what viruses and illnesses and plagues are going to befall. But again, this is not inadvertent. This is a determined effort, a designed plan that Israel has been waiting to unleash, and it has.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable, mind-boggling what is taking place and how everyone is watching it. I mean, based on this international rules-based community that exists right now, do you think that this same community then will actually play a role in stopping this genocide?
I'm not waiting for the world community to all of a sudden grow principle of justice and independence and to move on behalf of a targeted people. If for that, you know, we will be generations away. But I am optimistic that the combination of movement at the ICC, movement at universal jurisdictions, but most important, millions of young, largely young women and men worldwide in the streets, demonstrating, the BDS movement expanding, Israeli military factories and plants that are providing information being demonstrated against, civil disobedience there. There have been acts of criminal mischief as well. So I think this combination, and keep in mind, I'm not naive. I don't believe that Biden or the West or anyone with this is going to step in until after Israel has been able to accomplish the next step of its never-ending Nakba that it's designed to do. But I think they're reaching, and they're not going to step in out of principle or out of purpose or out of passion or out of love or out of humanity. But it's going to reach a point where politically it's boomeranging back against them, and that's when they're going to step in. But meanwhile, the fact that Netanyahu has been given a green light, I mean, now he's invading the South. They displaced 1.5 million people in the north and the center of Gaza and sent them down basically to the south. And now the tanks are rolling into the south and there's no defense. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians, civilians, again, being slaughtered every day. There are variables, and I'm not suggesting or proposing that Hezbollah or Syria or anyone else continue their involvement or expand it. But that's an issue. Using the old anecdote, the colloquialism, the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop, there's increasing tension and fighting going on with Syria is pushing back again. I suspect the West Bank is going to explode. The real issue is I think there's going to come a point in time. Let us not forget, this is as much about Netanyahu trying to save himself from a judicial process that he's under indictment, I believe, in 2 or 3 cases, and the trials are beginning again. In Netanyahu's mind, as long as he can say we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, he's safe. In the minds of the Kahanists that now run the military, the industrial military complex, the security state, as long as they get to say, see what they did to us, us, they're allowed to expand, they're allowed to justify increasing violence, expansion of so-called settlements. I don't know how it's going to play out at this point. One thing is for sure, that resolution, meanwhile, is thousands of Palestinian lives are being lost to the lust, the political lust, not just of Israel, but the proxy masters of the West that have been involved in this situation. And it's not just the West. I look at UAE, I look at Bahrain, I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at Morocco, I look at other Arab states or Gulf states that have been complicit throughout. I look at the fact that we had to beg Egypt to open Rafah even periodically for goods and services to come in. And meanwhile says, yes, we'll let Rafah should be open so that we can displace 1 million Palestinians. Egypt, you deal. Push them off into the Sinai. Let's send the Bedouin back to the desert. So we have complicity among certain states in the region. And then we have other states that have long supported Palestine. Iran is one. Doha, Qatar has been there. Algeria has been there. South Africa and African states have been there. So we've got this tension that's underway right now, and I'd like to be able to predict with some modicum of certainty how it's going to end up, but I really can't at this point.
Well, Stanley, I'd like to hear your final comments about the overall situation.
The situation is very clear on what's going on in Palestine. I think the world community, especially the young women and men of the world community, need to stay in the streets, need to demonstrate, need to engage in all sorts of activities against governments, need to make sure that the political leadership understand there's a price to pay for their blind, obedient support for Israeli genocide. I send my love and solidarity to the Palestinian people. They know they are loved. They know they have support. We will fight with them. We will work with them. We will struggle with them. We will never forget we are family.
Stanley Cohen, it's been a pleasure having you on Hidden Files. I'd like to welcome my colleague, Maryam Azadcher, to Hidden Files. She's going to bring us a little bit more information about other situations taking place since October the 7th. Well, Maryam, welcome to the Hidden Files team. It's a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being part of this team.
Well, I'd like to look at, because outside of the Palestinian territories, there were other situations taking place that has had a big effect. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. So now what happened is that in bombing Gaza indiscriminately, the Israeli regime didn't just destroy Palestinian homes, schools, and hospitals. It also destroyed the widely believed myth that the international law was created to defend the rights of oppressed nations, and therefore there's no need for armed resistance. Now, today, this law has no real legitimacy and power in the eyes of millions who have seen Palestinian parents pull out the bodies of their children from under the rubble in the deafening silence of the so-called international community.
It's often said that one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Well, in this case, one colonialist terrorist is a nation's resistance fighter, and this has held true throughout history, where indigenous peoples, like Palestinians, were invaded using lethal weapons, stripped of their lands, using legal weapons and documents, and portrayed as the perpetrators of using the weapon of media. But there's one thing these powers cannot win without your consent. And that is the control of your mind. So next time they ask you to condemn those fighting against colonial interests, maybe let them know that you have read their history. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us on this Hidden Files. It's time. If you ever
ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Majad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of God, I mean Ramadan, and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, somebody asked, my gums often bleed and the blood gets mixed up with saliva sometimes. At times, I'm not sure whether the saliva that enters my throat is mixed with blood or not. What's this situation? Is his fast valid, Sheikh Javed? Would you please enlighten us regarding this individual's situation?
Well, if the blood from the gums dissolves in the saliva, dissolves means that it disappears. Once it gets mixed with the saliva, it disappears in such a way that it seems to be non-existent at all. And what is seen is saliva, not blood. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is actually called dissolution of the blood into the saliva. So the saliva actually is as pure and it can be swallowed. And swallowing the saliva, no matter how much the quantity, will not affect the fast. And in such cases, actually, the fast is valid, and there's no objection to it. And if you are not sure, as you rightly mentioned, whether the saliva is mixed with blood or not, again, it can be swallowed without any problem, without any objection.
Mm-hmm, I see. Sheikh Javed, you know, we all know that as Muslims who fast, it's always advisable to clean your mouth with any means possible, whether it is brushing your teeth or any way possible, so that there wouldn't be any residue of food in your mouth when you're fasting. So if, you know, somebody forgets to do so, I mean, forgets brushing their teeth, then there is always the risk of this bits of or tiny pieces of food in their mouth to be swallowed, all right?
Yes.
And if they do so, even unintentionally, how should they go about this? Should they offer the qadha of that day because they, well, ate maybe some pieces of food?
Sure. Well, there are some details which I would like to provide for our listeners. First of all, brushing the teeth is allowed in and of itself, as long as you make sure that no paste, no actually foreign ingredients go into your throat.
Yes.
You make sure, and then you brush your teeth, keep your teeth clean, there is no problem. But when it comes to the, to the bits of food remaining in between your teeth, and you want to actually throw it out, but okay, you unintentionally end up swallowing it. According to His Eminence, it is said that if you did not know that some bits of food remain between the teeth,
mm-hmm.
He says,
okay.
And you did not know that they would reach the throat and they were swallowed unintentionally and unknowingly, actually, then you are not liable for any qadha. You do not have to make up your fast. Because first of all, okay, there were some bits of food, but you did not know it, okay? Or maybe there were some bits of food and you knew it, but you unintentionally, you swallowed it, so your qada, your fast is not invalid, and there's no need to make any qada. What is forbidden is actually to intentionally and deliberately and knowingly swallow the bits, the tiny bits of food that remain in between the teeth.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back to continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. مرحب مرحب يا رمضان أحيي قلوبنا بالقرآن حل ليالينا بالقيام أهلا أهلا بالصيام.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest as speaker. Well, we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javid. The gums of a person, Sheikh Javid, who's fasting, bleeds a lot, all right?
Yes.
Well, does this invalidate this individual's fast?
Well, as we discussed it earlier, probably in this episode or maybe in the previous episode, the bleeding gums does not invalidate the fast unless the blood is swallowed. Okay, if you do not swallow the blood, or maybe if the blood is mixed with the saliva and the blood stains disappear because it is dissolved in the saliva, of course, in such a way that there is no there are no traces of blood seen, then the fast is not made void.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What about pouring some water over one's head? Does this invalidate one's fast?
No, it does not invalidate the fast because it's not considered to be a kind of immersion underwater. Everybody who performs ghusl, maybe during the day, they have to pour water on their head to wash it, to use shampoo and then pour water. And pouring water does not actually in any way affect the fast, unless you want to immerse your head underwater, which is something else. It's a different issue.
Yes.
Immersion makes the fast void, immersing your head underwater.
Mm, I see. Okay. Well, there are certain medicines, Sheikh Javid, for feminine illnesses that are usually applied through the vagina. Does their use invalidate the fast?
Well, the use of such medicine does not invalidate the fast, mm-hmm. no matter, because it's taken vaginally, through the vagina.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And His Eminence states that it does not affect the fast. No matter what it is.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Javed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javed, would you please explain to us, or to our dear audience, your view and opinion on having injections while fasting during this blessed month, I mean Ramadan. Do injections basically invalidate fast?
To be honest, this is a very important question and very much frequently asked by by mu'minin across the world. They keep wondering whether injections affect the fast or not. According to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it is based on obligatory precaution for the fasting person, ihtiyati wajib, for the fasting person to avoid having any kind of supportive, nutritional, or intravenous injections, okay, as a measure of obligatory precaution. So the same rule is applied to all kinds of intravenous fluid, infusions. And they one should a fast person should avoid having such kind of injections. And I should say that the scholars, the religious authorities, differ in their opinions when it comes to the injections, the shots they take during the month of Ramadan. According to some scholars, all kinds of injections are allowed, whether they are nutritional or they are actually sedative.
How interesting.
Yeah. They do not affect the fast. But, okay, when it comes to Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion, may Allah grant him long life, he's of the view that, okay, one should avoid having nutritional injections while fasting. But when it comes to non-nutritional intramuscular injections, like, for example, antibiotics, okay, and painkillers, you see, anesthetic injections, they are allowed because they are not nutritional.
I see. What about pills, like, for example, for high blood pressure?
If taking these pills during Ramadan is necessary for controlling high blood pressure, of course, it is permissible, but it definitely invalidates the fast because you take it, you take it through that through your throats, and it's not a form of injection or something, okay? Pills always make the fast wider, and the religious authorities are actually unanimous in their opinion when it comes to pills.
So what happens to these people? Should they offer the qadha of the missed fast? Because obviously their blood pressure is high, so they have to take it every day.
You know, blood pressure may be fluctuating. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. If they are confident that their blood pressure will not go up while fasting, okay, they should fast and take the pills sometime before before dawn or after, the iftar time, if it is possible. If not, if they are supposed to take the pills during the day, they have to go ahead and act according to their doctor's advice. And of course, when it comes to qadha, they have to observe the qadha whenever it's possible in the following months. When the days are shorter, of course, or maybe it's colder, and when it's propitious in terms of taking the fast, they should do so.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javed, as the host of this program. And on behalf of the rest of the crew here, we bid you farewell and say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
ما چطور عیدمون رو مبارک کنیم؟ تو هر فامیلی دانشجو و معلم داریم با کم و زیادش.
How can we bless our New Year celebrations during Nowruz? One good way is to share our knowledge with others. For instance, if we are a teacher or trainer, we can share our knowledge and experiences with the students or the children. There are always some teens or youth who lack enough knowledge about a lesson or course. Our free time during New Year celebration is the best time to help them, since helping a brother or sister in faith makes Allah happy.
کار خیلی کشوکش اومد بکنید منتظر این که او دیدن من نیمم من برم دیدنش.
Another way to bless our lives is to lower our expectations from others. We must not wait for others to respect us or they visit us first. According to Islamic ethics, we can respect others in advance and take the spiritual rewards. Muslims can take many lessons from springtime when all the nature becomes new. We must be new too by changing our bad behaviors to good ones. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome. And this week, we are discussing the ongoing South Africa's genocide case against the Israeli regime at the International Court of Justice, ICJ. Now, the case has drawn the admiration of all freedom seekers worldwide. We have a special guest to discuss the topic today. He's none other than South African Ambassador to Iran, His Excellency Dr. Francis Moloi. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Mubarak. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we know, many freedom seekers worldwide and people who love peace, they have welcomed South Africa's case against the Israeli apartheid regime at the ICC over its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, first, can you tell us what was the motivation or the factors behind South Africa's move to initiate this very historical case?
Well, the people of Palestine have been under occupation for over 75 years. Yeah. And they have not enjoyed the rights and freedoms that we as the world community have proclaimed on, particularly after the Second World War.
Yeah.
They have been on the receiving end of Israeli brutality, Israeli violence, violation of human rights and freedoms, denial of rights. And that situation of the Nakba has been continuing since 1948.
Yeah.
But what we saw since October last year is unprecedented in recent memory.
Yeah.
And when we looked at the totality of what the apartheid government in Israel has done, for us it is a very clear, straightforward, open and shut textbook case of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has happened in Gaza flows directly from the genocidal instructions, genocidal statements that were uttered by the top state functionaries in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And those instructions and statements were carried to the letter by the IDF.
Yeah.
And when we look at everything that has happened, every single one of those violations that have been committed fit very neatly the provisions of Article 2 of the Genocide Convention.
Yeah.
It is clear that these actions by the Israeli Defense Force are aimed at killing the members of the group, which are the Palestinians, to cause them immense bodily and mental harm. Everything has been done to ensure the total destruction of Palestinian lives. Everything has been done to prevent the births in the Palestinian community. And if you look at that for us, that is a textbook definition of what a genocide is. But why did we decide to go to the ICJ and not any other court?
Yeah.
Because, first of all, the ICJ is the only tribunal in the system of international law that has jurisdiction to decide disputes over genocide.
Yeah.
South Africa, as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, like Israel and all other countries, we all have an obligation, a binding obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent the crime of genocide and to punish it.
Mm-hmm.
The other very important consideration that we took into account was that Israel itself is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and by its signature, it has consented to the jurisdiction of the ICJ over the disputes related to the crime of genocide. And we as South Africa, by virtue of the fact that we also have an obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent that crime, we do not need to be a party to the current conflict that's going in there. So we have what lawyers call locus standi, in the ICJ, and therefore that gives us, that opportunity or that privilege to present this case on behalf of the Palestinians in the ICJ.
And by the way, you know, we remember that after the Rwanda genocide, the world said never again, and it's happening again, unfortunately. In its ruling, the ICJ issued interim orders that the Israeli regime must take measures to prevent genocide. But I think the regime is intent on continuing its genocidal war, backed by the U.S. And we have seen what is happening in Rafah. So, what's your take on this? I mean, it's total impunity on the part of the Israeli regime.
That has been our experience with the apartheid government in Israel for a very long time.
Yeah.
They have acted completely with impunity, and they have enjoyed political, diplomatic support and cover from their some of their partners in the West.
Yeah.
And that has been quite unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Now, these provisional measures that the court has ordered, and we must be very clear, those provisional measures are binding on Israel, and they are binding on all of us as far as our obligations to prevent genocide are concerned. So the fact that the court has ordered these measures, there is also a corresponding obligation on all of us to ensure that Israel complies with these orders. For instance, it was really disappointing to see, particularly after the provisional measures were ordered, to see Israel's partners continuing to support Israel through provision of arms. And taking actions like withdrawing funding from UNRWA, the consequence of which is that it will perpetuate the genocidal decision on the part of Israel to starve the people of Gaza of food, medicines, and other essentials.
Mm-hmm.
So Israel is under an obligation to comply with these measures.
Yeah.
And the rest of us must ensure that Israel complies with this, and that we do not take actions that will continue to perpetuate the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza.
Members of the U.S. Congress have called for, a review of South Africa-U.S. ties because of your country's stance at the ICC. And, South Africa is resisting and has that resolve to move on. So what do you view all these threats? Have you received other, threats to downgrade ties or, to pressurize you to withdraw from your support for Palestine?
Yes, we have seen, and you are referring to the United States, we have seen pieces of legislation that have been proposed in this context, as you say, to review our bilateral relations with the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know exactly what that means, but the U.S.'s own internal legislative processes, those are processes over which we have no control whatsoever. But what I will say, Mubarak, is this, that our decision to take this route is informed by the principles, the norms, the values, the standards that underpin our engagement with the world.
Yeah.
At a multilateral level, at a bilateral level.
Yeah.
And we, in our foreign policy, we are very clear. We are informed by principles such as respect for human life, multilateralism, the desire to have international relations governed by pre-agreed rules, as opposed to international relations being governed by a brute military and economic and political power.
Yeah.
We believe in a system of international relations that respects the rule of international law,
mm-hmm.
that seeks to resolve pressing political conflicts through peaceful means.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to, in order to ensure that we can live by these principles, we want to ensure that those institutions of global governance, like the United Nations, and those instruments of international legal systems, like the human rights legal systems, international humanitarian law, and all this, that we can use this and rely on this to address mm-hmm. the problems that we face in the world. And our approach through the ICJ is simply our desire to work within an agreed framework or so.
Mm-hmm.
So if other countries think that we shouldn't be doing that, or that if we pursue that that route, we need to be punished, well, it is something that over which we have no control. But what we know that we are fortified in our approach.
Yeah.
It's a principled approach that
we're
taking.
Impressive.
And this is the correct way of approaching it.
Now, and this brings in the issue of double standards, you know, within the international system. You know, like during this conflict, Ukraine-Russia conflict, we've seen the ICC has issued, you know, arrest warrants or summons against Russian President Vladimir Putin. But within 3 or 4 months, the Israeli regime has killed 30,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. And no warrant of arrest has been issued against the Israeli regime's Prime Minister Netanyahu. What's your take on these double standards?
Mubarak, my brother, you use the term double standards, and you are absolutely right to characterize how some of these international rules have been applied. And that is unfortunate because we cannot have a system of international law that applies or uses different rules and criteria for some and a different set of rules for the other.
Yeah.
That will simply breed contempt for the rules of international law. That
Indeed.
Will only bring this global system of rules into disrepute.
Yeah.
And it doesn't augur well for the global community going forward.
Yeah.
So it is regrettable that some of these institutions of global governance, and you have referred to the ICC, that in the case of President Putin, and now in the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu and some of the leaders of the apartheid regime in Israel, different set of rules are being applied.
Exactly.
And that is unacceptable. We must have a system of international law that applies to all, because international law must be applied without fear, favor, or prejudice, equally so, and that way you can inspire confidence in these rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if we continue to operate on the basis of these double standards, we will not do any good to the international system as a whole.
Yeah. Now, Israeli regime officials have accused South Africa of working closely with the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, and even say that South Africa on these claims.
We heard that, and that was one of the first accusations that Israel made when we took the case up to the ICJ.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that is in the strategy of the Israeli government.
Mm-hmm.
Those that it doesn't agree with, it will always label them. In our case now, we have been labeled as the legal arm of Hamas.
Yeah.
We have been labeled anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, and all this. And this is a strategy that they use to delegitimize, to pour scorn over the principled course of action that that we have we have taken. And these insults, really, and these labels are usually the refuge of someone who does not have a case.
Yeah.
And therefore, these don't mean anything to us indeed. And I imagine that we are being labeled the legal arm of Hamas because in the eyes of Israel, Hamas is a terrorist organization, so it is regarded. But we do not regard Hamas as a terrorist organization, indeed. And we find those labels and comments to be utterly preposterous.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has also been at the forefront of rejecting attempts by the Israeli apartheid regime to infiltrate the African Union. And the last attempt, two Israeli regime's officials were actually ejected from an AU summit in Addis Ababa. Can we now consider, following this genocide in Gaza, can we now consider that that case is closed and the regime will no longer be considered even for being an observer member of the African Union?
The issue of Israel as an observer in the AU is an issue that our leaders still need to discuss at the summit level.
Yeah.
However, from South Africa's point of view, we are very clear.
Yeah.
We will oppose any decision, any application that seeks to admit Israel as an observer in the AU.
Yeah.
And the events since October last year, the genocide that Israel has carried out against the people of Palestine is in fact another solid reason why Israel's attempts to be an observer in the AU ought to be rejected.
Rejected, Now, we have seen many countries have expressed support, you know, to South Africa's case against the Israeli regime at the ICJ. Now, how will this impact on South Africa in terms of global geopolitics?
Well, yes, we have many countries have expressed support for South Africa going forward, which we appreciate, of course, and which I think the people of Palestine appreciate. As to how this will impact on geopolitics, I guess this the jury is still out there.
It's unfolding.
Exactly. But for us, we have this case to prosecute. We think we have made a very strong case going forward.
Yeah.
We have now passed the provisional measures.
Yeah.
And we are glad that at the end of the submissions that we made on the 11th of January, when other countries had labeled our course of action as meritless, as baseless, as without any basis whatsoever, the ICJ agreed with us by and large.
Yeah.
And we ought now to be moving into the merits stage. And for us, that is what we are focusing on. What are the implications and the broader geopolitics of that would be? We leave that to others to deal with.
And now, and even the fact that many state and non-state actors are supporting South Africa's bid, do you think there will be changes in the international you know, system of justice, that there will be more focus, people will have some hope on this international court of justice and even the ICC? Are we going to see an evolution towards more trust to these institutions?
From where I'm sitting, Mubarak, my brother, I think that this case has awakened the conscience of ordinary people on Main Street. And these protests that we have seen across the world, from Cape Town to London, from Washington, D.C. to
Sydney.
Ramallah, to all over, the ordinary people on the ground, through their various formations of civil society, have taken this issue upon their shoulders, and they are putting pressure on their governments to do something about the genocide in Gaza. The ceasefire now, the calls for the ceasefire, the calls for humanitarian aid, and the calls for holding the apartheid government in Israel accountable. All this is important, and it's a positive development because ordinary people on Main Street now realize that these commitments to international law, international principles ought to be implemented.
Yeah.
And I think if anything that will come out of this, it is that positive reawakening of the people on the ground.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, BRICS recently expanded to include more countries, including Iran, and it's emerging as a major force globally. What do you think, what role can BRICS play in resolving global conflicts like the current genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, BRICS is a grouping of mostly developing countries from the south.
Yeah.
And we have common objectives of pulling together our resources to develop our countries, our economies, to develop our people, and to foster greater cooperation and collaboration amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. And therefore, our cooperation mm-hmm. is in many fields mm-hmm. of economy, of politics, of culture, science and technology, and so on and so forth. And we also seek to adopt common approaches at resolving or addressing questions such as the conflict in Gaza. So BRICS becomes one of the important formations of the countries of the South to deal with all these challenges that we face today.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has been at the forefront, of resolving the Palestinian issue, and there have been so many proposals, there have been talks and negotiations that have failed because the Israeli apartheid regime has failed, to implement its commitments. And there is now this proposal, for example, Iran is proposing that one of the main ways of resolving the Palestinian conflict is through having a referendum that will involve all original inhabitants of Palestine, be they Jews, Christians, or Muslims, and even a referendum that will involve all Palestinian refugees who are scattered across the globe. Do you think this is a good solution? What's your take on this proposal to use a referendum to resolve the Palestinian issue?
Yes, so many proposals have been made about how to resolve the question of Palestine.
Yeah.
And we respect the sovereign position that the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken.
Yeah.
And we cannot contend, we cannot argue with that. It's a sovereign position of the Islamic Republic. But the important thing is that that proposal is also aimed at finding a durable, lasting peace for the people of Palestine. And we acknowledge and we appreciate and we endorse the principled support that Iran has provided to the people of Palestine. And it is part and parcel of that global effort to find accommodation and a solution to this.
Mr. Ambassador, our last question. The South African Parliament took a very decisive decision for recalling or the cutting of ties with the Israeli regime and the ejection of the Israeli ambassador from South Africa. And we've seen South Africans have also come out massively, to express support to Palestinians. Can you tell